This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off this week. Coming up, the United States' role in the devastating famine in the Horn of Africa. President Obama keeps dancing with the Republicans, trying to make that big deal. And what do hedge funds find so attractive about charter schools? But first, the hunger strike at California prisons ended after 20 days, although inmates say the struggle will continue. Prisoners began refusing food on July 1st in protest of what they call psychological torture. Some prisoners have been held in solitary confinement for up to 40 years at the infamous Pelican Bay facility. Dorsey Nunn is a director of the nonprofit organization Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. Prison officials say they're only interested in gathering information on gangs and keeping the prison secure. But Dorsey Nunn, who's himself a former inmate, says the real goal is to destroy the individual.
I think the prison authority is looking to break the spirit of human beings. I don't think they're looking for real stuff. You know, like some parts of the people that they ask in the debrief is people who have been in lockup for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. What do they have to give that's real data that would serve the interests of the state? If this is Black Agenda, I can absolutely tell you what Pelican Bay represents is the place that they would have sent Kunta Kinte to make them call themselves Toby. It ain't about that. Some parts of it is the debriefing is why should you be put into a situation where you're basically have to name names to come out of that situation. If you're going to be punished, you probably shouldn't be punished based on some behavior as opposed to some association. And if black people are listening to your radio program, what is being contained in Pelican Bay and probably a lot of my institutions when it comes to older black men could be the residue of the black power movement. So like when we say that there are political prisoners, see what they're attached to.
Yes, we've heard it said that we're not just talking about people who may or may not have had gang connections maybe 10 or 20 years ago, but also people who agitate within the prison walls.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other reality is that they had every gang connection. It still doesn't give the state the right to torture. So how affiliated do you have to be tortured and for it to be acceptable here? And even more importantly, is what makes it acceptable to other black people to have their family members tortured and we stand by silently? Because when I went to Pelican Bay and I interviewed some people, both of them, two of the people I interviewed probably in the last part of June, said the same thing. We miss black people. So it wasn't a question of just the institution that was isolated. They were isolated from their community. They talked about genocide of culture. They talked about manicide where you don't need to produce the body, but the only thing that you have to do is kill the spirit and hold the sperm.
So what the authorities are doing is trying to dehumanize, debase, humiliate the prisoners, and it has nothing to do with security.
No, and what they're trying to do is basically call them gangs, hoping that we will think about what the institution holds instead of holding the institution responsible for torture. They say gangs, we say woo, and we get scared, and we have never addressed the question, the primary question, that people stop eating in Pelican Bay, which was to stop themselves from being tortured.
Now, torture is against the law in the United States, last time I heard, and against the law under any circumstances.
And that's what we're yelling the loudest about. We didn't have to rendition not one human being because we're torturing people in Pelican Bay. So that hour and a half exercise time that they give a person while they lock them in the cell on 22 hours is probably not feeling any different in Pelican Bay than it would feel in Guantanamo Bay. And when they called it as torture in Guantanamo Bay, the world stood still and politicians ran over there. Not one politician felt enough about the human beings that could be our family members, could be our friends, and could be our neighbors to take themselves down to Pelican Bay and see about them. They accepted the definition and the framing of the Department of Corrections, who from all measures haven't told the truth, haven't actually obeyed court orders and any of that other stuff, and suddenly they become credible players in this scenario, And somebody needs to question that stuff. And I'm saying particularly, black people need to question that stuff.
And you're talking about black politicians as well as others.
Have you heard of anybody going in there? Any politician. We say that we're against torture, you know. What happens when our folks start saying what we're being subject to is torture? And by the way, some parts of the reason that they constructed Guantanamo Bay was for the purpose of extracting information. Are they not trying to extract information in Pelican Bay? Are they not using sensory deprivation in Pelican Bay? Are they not using isolation in Pelican Bay? If these are the same thing, the only thing that they ain't admitted to in Pelican Bay is waterboarding. If you lock somebody up in the bathroom for 30 and 40 years and don't let them, and don't have a natural light coming in and leaving the light on all night and only giving them an hour and a half on the yard, probably every day or every other day, and a yard, and the yard they give them is really a dog walk, have no grass, and you can't see over the 20-foot wall thing. Some guys, like one of the guys got excited because he had seen a tree 8 years early. So I don't know what you want to call torture, and I don't know what they want to call sensory deprivation. The guy that I spoke to who walked out to visit me, he walked out with his dreads down to his ankle, and he could have just climbed up out of the ship Armistead. So I don't know about all of this, the political ramifications for what they're doing. All I know is they're torturing human beings, and I think that black people should recognize who goes to prison and who do you think they're torturing.
And people are going insane as a result of that torture.
And not only are they going insane, like when Pelican Bay opened and in its first 3 years when they boiled Von Dirch and they was talking about they was going to put the worst of the worst, the person who went insane that first brought it to the attention that they were housing mentally people who were having mental breakdowns, they actually started smearing feces on itself. In addition to smearing feces on itself, when they went to address the problem, they put him in a water that peeled his skin and talked about they was going to scrub off both the feces and his blackness. That was the first case that came to light. And then when you read any of the literature, they could anticipate that people will ultimately start smearing, some people will, with mental health challenges, will ultimately start smearing feces on themselves because this is one of the things that naturally occur in those conditions. So when I got into it and I said, well, this happened in Pelican Bay, it didn't, like, I didn't stop there. It was like I started reading about in some of the literature and some of the articles and in the medical reports that this thing was happening in other prisons in regards to people being isolated. So it's not like they don't know. You can make a damn phone call from death row and can't make a phone call from Pelican Bay. I mean, the privilege that they want to give them is the privilege of receiving one picture of a family member and to send one picture out of a family of themselves. Some of these guys, we did a survey prior to, you know, because I didn't know I was going to get involved in this stuff in terms of supporting them in any particular way. My name of my organization is I'm the Executive Director of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. The first thing that we did was survey them about when was the last time they had a contact visit and what was their relationship to kids. That's what gets me into driving 7 hours up into the middle of nowhere because I started getting reports back. I ain't seen my children in 20 years. And I do this interview just to make sure if something goes wrong that we know how to notify people's families because we figure like it could go awfully wrong because we didn't think that the state really cared about the people they held. And I don't even know if I agree with the strategy because I couldn't figure out what would make the state give you food when they hate you. So I go up and I interview these guys, and what comes up is they hadn't seen their families, and what comes up is this strike stuff. I'm sitting there witnessing human rights violations or hearing about human rights violations that they're counting on people out here to stop their rights from being violated since they don't think that the courts have that ability to deliver that. I've been visiting institutions, either family members, since the age of 5. I was in an institution for 11 years, and then I was visiting institutions in my professional life for 30 years. Pelican Bay is the place that I left, and it was the only time that I left a visit, and I wanted to cry, you know, because I didn't know how to explain to myself how I sit by on the sidelines and let human beings be treated this way while I remain silent. And at this point, I do have a voice. And I wasn't amplifying and focusing on that somewhere in the United States, and it's probably more than Pelican Bay, because if they're getting away with it there, they're getting away with it all over the place.
And if George Jackson was alive today, he'd probably be in the shoe in Pelican Bay, too.
Well, hey, George Jackson, theoretical crime partner, Hugo Pinnell is alive today, and he's been in the hole for 40 years. And the people go to Pelican Bay, they put them in the hole because they read George Jackson's literature. That's enough to get you classified as a gang member. So if they come in the cell and find a book, Blood in My Eye, or Solidarity Brothers, or you got an obituary of George Jackson's mama, it's enough to get you classified as being a part of the BGF and put in the hole. So those are the type of people that we're putting in the hole. So, like, you know, I don't know, when I get finished dropping off a whole bunch of Michelle Alexander's books, if they're not going to say Michelle didn't create a gang. Because I'm going to send some books to some brothers in the pen so they can actually read, because maybe God grants them a blessing, or they get lucky and they get out, and I hope that they're conscious when they come home. That's the point that I think that is real significance on a lot of levels, that you can actually get put in the hole and classified as a gang member based on the material that you read. So when I say you don't have to get there because you stabbed somebody, you don't have to get there because you moved some dope, you can get there because the guy in the next cell, you talk too long to him, or you walked them out in the yard with him, or they come in the cell and somebody that gave you some book, a book that you didn't read, that they don't think that you should be reading, and then suddenly you in a world of trouble. And the people who actually get in the hole half the time because somebody said something about them. And I don't know. When we force people to name names and we threaten them with torture, it's if the information is accurate information to begin with. They're just trying to avoid and protect and save their own life. They may not necessarily feel that inclined. The other thing that we've been putting out in the general public is that people normally don't tell on real gang members. They tell on other people that ain't got no power to hurt their family.
That was Dorsey Nunn of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children in San Francisco. The Horn of Africa is experiencing the worst drought in 60 years, with 10 million people threatened in Somalia, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Djibouti. Somalia has been officially declared a place of famine. Christian Parenti is a journalist and author of the book Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Parenti says to understand the disaster in Somalia, one must know something about the history of the region.
If we moved backwards in history, there's a failed state in Somalia, and that was produced by U.S. military support for the Somali dictator Saeed Barre in his war with Ethiopia, and Soviet support for the Ethiopians. It allowed that war to drag on and on from 1977 really until 1991, when Somalia collapsed. That's one initial cause of why the drought leads to famine. The drought, which is clearly linked to climate change. I mean, one cannot say that any specific weather event is caused by climate change, but what we can say is that the pattern that this drought fits into is caused by climate change, which is one of increased drought, disruption of the weather patterns like the monsoon cycle, the disruption of the intertropical convergence zone, which is the weather pattern, a belt of clouds that moves north and south across the tropics annually that governs the pattern of rainy seasons in much of the equatorial parts of the planet. These systems are falling out of whack due to climate change, and we see increased drought and punctuated by extreme flooding, and the drought is part of that pattern. But then also climate change elsewhere. In Russia last year, worst drought in 100 years, caused Russia to ban grain exports. Flooding in the Midwest and Canada caused the price of corn to almost double. These are factors that then make it affect the world food system and make it harder for people to purchase food in places where their crops may be suffering due to drought, but then when they turn to the world market, their meager resources go even a shorter distance because the food prices have doubled in the last year. And also speculation has been part of that too. Glencore and Cargill, major firms, major commodity firms, have been speculating wildly on grain. But then also neoliberal economic restructuring. The systematic dismantling of state capacity in the global south means that there are more populations that are vulnerable to bad weather because there's less support for pastoralists in Kenya, small farmers in Kenya, when they face drought. There isn't famine in Kenya, but there's severe drought and hunger and problems setting in Kenya, even though that's where many of the people from Somalia are going to. So there's layers and layers of causality, some human-made, some natural.
And in fact, many people have said that the conflict in Darfur is also closely related to the problem of desertification.
Yes. The standard explanation for Darfur is that the pastoralists and the farmers had a kind of symbiotic relationship whereby the pastoralists would cross the farmland after the harvest and their animals would graze on the stalks that remained and also fertilize the fields as they passed through. This relationship works fine if the rainy seasons come on time and at the right time. And when the weather systems became disrupted, there became more and more incidents of conflict where pastoralists, due to drought, were driven out of one place and driven prematurely into the croplands of the farmers. And then conflict develops between these modes of production due to climatological crisis. And then this gets articulated as a Muslim Arab population from the north and a Christian and animist population from the south in conflict, and that this is, you know, religious or that this is racial, even though there's no phenotypical difference between these people, but one side is considered Arab, the other side is considered African. The real issue is farmers and pastoralists falling into conflict with each other because the climate is unraveling, because industrialized nations have been pumping CO2 into the atmosphere for almost 200 years now, and we're finally feeling the effects of it in the form of a warmer planet making the climate fall apart.
In the media, we keep on hearing about the Somali drought, but that drought affects 10 million people, only about 3 million of them citizens of Somalia, and many of them in the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, which is largely shut off to observation by the outside world.
Yes, we don't know what's going on in Eritrea. The international community has asked the Eritrean government to report on conditions there. I was, for my book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, I reported from Somali regions of Kenya and from the Turkana in northwest Kenya. And there has been a series of droughts that have come so close together, these three droughts, you could essentially call it one long 10-year drought that's been punctuated by a few half proper rainy seasons. But yeah, there are many different societies that are suffering from drought. And of course, the thing that people should remember is that drought only becomes famine when it is compounded by bad policy. The reason that the drought translates as famine in Somalia is because there is a failed state in Somalia. Somalia is in a state of war, and that was a product of the Cold War, of that conflict I was mentioning earlier, and Saeed Barre's irredentist claims on the Ogaden and his refusal to accept defeat and then the collapse of his military, and the willingness of the United States and its allies to fund, in the name of fighting communism, this madman, Saeed Barre, who was willing to destroy his own army and then his own country in the pursuit of this goal. As a result, there's a failed state, and the U.S. response to this is some CIA involvement and trying to hunt down al-Qaeda elements, but that will not help bring stability to the region, unfortunately.
Well, the United States massively backed and instigated Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia in late 2006. As early as last year, the United States was withholding food aid from warehouses in Kenya to pressure aid agencies not to pay any fees to the Shabab fighters. And apparently that is the point where the total breakdown with the Shabab and the food aid.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. That is important, crucial history. And Ethiopia is now a U.S. client state. You put your finger on exactly the way in which the war on terror, I mean, it was the Cold War that destroyed Somalia, and now it's the war on terror that is sealing its fate. I mean, there was a moment before the Shabab where the Islamic courts had control over Mogadishu. Now, I'm not going to romanticize at all the basic, that was a Somali Taliban, essentially. But the one thing you could say for the Islamic courts was it was at least a kind of rule of law, system of rule of law, and it seemed like one side had finally won, and there was kind of like cobbling together some sort of order between the clans. And it was in response to that that the U.S. really starts ramping up the Ethiopian invasion for fear that this would be another Islamist state, you know, another Afghanistan. I mean, of course, never mind that Saudi Arabia is a similar state that the U.S. is completely fine with. Its laws preventing women from driving is, you know, full of wealthy middle classes who fund radical movements throughout the Middle East and North Africa. But the idea that there could be a kind of Taliban state in Somalia, it appears from looking from the outside, and as you've just described through U.S. actions, that the U.S. preferred further instability rather than having to reckon with a jihadist state. Not that I'm saying, oh, a jihadist state would have been great, it would have been nice, but, you know, what we have now is a continued state of war. And you're absolutely right to point out that that is when the Shabab, which is sort of, my understanding, is the successors to the Islamic courts movement, kicked out the aid agencies.
Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. President Obama has been on a quest for an agreement with the Republicans on the budget. Both Obama and the GOP want to make huge cuts in social programs. Most Democrats on Capitol Hill have been left on the sidelines, watching Obama's dance with the Republicans. We spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, an activist and journalist based in South Carolina. He says Obama's big deal with the GOP is a bad deal for the people.
I think he and Barnier keep trying to negotiate what they are calling also a grand bargain. But it sure won't be a bargain for poor people. It won't be a bargain for working class people. It won't be a bargain for people who believe that Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and some of the programs that were instituted during the New Deal under FDR, it won't be good or a grand bargain for the people who believe that those kinds of programs tie us together and make sure that we're a country that's compassionate and a country that looks out for the least of these.
It looks like this grand bargain would entail $3 in cuts for every projected dollar in new revenue, a kind of dance he's doing with Republicans, and most progressive Democrats aren't in this dance.
Well, you know, everybody keeps talking about how do we deal with the deficit, and no one wants to deal with the Bush tax cuts and what that means. It seems that everybody wants to use the metaphor of the house, the homeowners or the family around the table having to balance a budget every month. Well, you know, some of those analogies fall short in that, you know, when you're a family, you have a house, you have a car, you have bills, and you're not paying cash for your car and you're not paying cash for your house. Everybody pretty much lives, if they pay bills, in a deficit. So that's just the way life is. It's no such thing as a family that has a so-called zero balance budget with no deficit. But the other part of that is, if you're talking about family budgets, how many families are going to commit 60% of their income on buying weapons and guns and bullets to protect their property? So people ought to talk about all these wars and talk about these Bush tax cuts and the things that created the problem that we're facing, instead of the sounding this alarm, this false alarm, which Obama and Republicans do, saying that Social Security is in trouble. The only reason it's in trouble is because they keep taking money away from it to pay for things for the rich or to pay for these wars of exploitation and militarism and colonialism.
I believe that even Obama's suggested savings to the military budget, which actually would allow the military budget to increase, only on his paper amount to about $40 billion a year, which is a third the cost of the Afghanistan war.
Look, it's obvious, if you just want to open your eyes, that there is no help in the White House for people who have a progressive economic political agenda, which means that we ought to have a country that does more for working class people, that protects people when they get old, that has a public education system that's well funded, instead of now the new thing is Obama doesn't send his kids to public schools because he doesn't think they're up to muster. And, of course, now you have people like Chris Christie who can insult people about his kids being in a private school, or Rahm Emanuel can talk about putting his kids in a private school. We ought to be talking about what a progressive economic structure looks like and working toward that. And we ought not back down. If we believe in socialism and the rich need to pay more and the government needing to do more to make life more sustainable as opposed to just competing and having this whole militaristic war identity and war attitude, and everybody thinks that they might be a slave owner, or which equates to being a millionaire, so they protect the rights of the rich when the rich aren't passing any of that down. When you look at what's happened on Wall Street with all that money that went to Wall Street through the TARP, and that money being held or being used to pay off bonuses or being used to pay off dividends, at some point in time, the American working class and the American people ought to get hip to what's happening with this government in cahoots with the rich and demand that we have real structural change in this country.
There was a time, and it wasn't too long ago, although now it feels like ancient history, when we could count on at least a significant segment of the Congressional Black Caucus and some of the traditional black civil rights organizations to be making the kinds of arguments you just made, but not now.
Well, right now it's just about not making Obama look bad as it relates to the caucus, and to some extent, Republicans and Tea Partiers are treating Barack Obama like a nigger, in that they've raised the debt ceiling numerous times without all this hoopla, without all this drama. So, you know, his lack of gravitas and lack of, he thinks he can step on his base, but the fact that he doesn't have his base backing him, and he doesn't have anything that he really believes in as a principle, he looks weak, and they treat him like they treat him. A lot of what's happening in black leadership and in the black community, they just don't want him to look bad cosmetically as opposed to demanding anything of him structurally. And, you know, when you look at black organizations on the grassroots level, now they are starting to get a grip on the fact that we've got to deal with these voter ID laws and the immigration laws that are being passed in the South. But primarily, their concern is that it diminishes the amount of votes that Barack Obama might get in his reelection. They're not really so concerned about the civil rights aspect of it. It's about whether or not we can keep a black face in office just for the sake of having a black face in office.
I have never seen in my conscious life a black community that was so neutralized and quiet in the face of power.
Well, there's no leadership on any level. And it's not just about Barack Obama. It's just about the total buyout and breakdown of ideology and a leadership cadre, or even the folk who run for office now in the community. They don't represent a movement ethos or moving, as they say, to ball forward as it relates to civil rights and human rights and the cause of reparations. They're about getting elected to office. Like Obama, it's about them. It's not about us.
President Obama in 2006 voted against raising the debt ceiling himself. That sounds like one of his famous signals.
Well, I don't know about famous signals. It's always been clear from the moment Barack Obama ran for office, started talking about running for office, when he first feigned membership in the DLC, Barack Obama has been about advancing the cause of the Wall Street fat cats, doing what he needed to do for his political career and not necessarily adjoining himself to any kind of progressive cause, at least only cosmetically. He was linked to Trinity and Reverend Wright and the whole idea of multiculturalism and being a member of the black community when it suited him. But after the folk decided that he was the one that they could use, it's been a different story since then. And then, of course, even when you look at his wife and her political relationships, you know, why she went to work with the Chicago hospital pretty much to drive poor people from those hospitals, and her working with the Foreign Relations Council, it ought to be obvious that these people are not agents of the working class.
The Democratic Leadership Council, which was the corporate bagman for the Democratic Party, basically closed up shop in February. Could it be because, well, they already won?
They've won. They have absolutely won. Blue Dog, DLC, New Democrat, Glavhat, Full Democrat, whatever you want to call them, Wall Street Democrats. I'm looking out for I, Me, My Democrats. I'm going to corporatize everything from education to national pension fund. I'm going to turn over universal health care to Wall Street. That's the kind of Democrat we have in office right now.
So when black folks try to build a wall around President Obama, they're actually building a wall around those right-wing Democratic corporate policies.
Well, what they're doing is building a big old deep hole that when Barack Obama is gone, they'll be stuck in while he'll be a multimillionaire talking about their misery. And maybe they'll even take him in for him to be their leader, because it seems that that's how naive people are right now.
Is it naivete, or is it a certain greed in certain classes within the black community, or a combination?
It's a combination, because obviously greed and this idea of creature comforts and material comforts gets the best of everybody. And no question, if you're in the land of plenty and glitz and glamour, folk get comfortable. If you're not missing a meal, if you're not having to negotiate to pay your light bill, if you're not having to stand in line, if you don't have to worry about being redlined over insurance rates from car to homeowners to whatever, if you don't have those kinds of worries, it's hard for you to relate to those people that have those kinds of worries. And so that's where we're at right now. It's going to take a movement of people, let the country go into default, and let checks not be mailed to grandma and grandpa, and let's see what happens then.
Many of us felt that gridlock would be far better than acquiescence to these Republican demands, corporate demands, and now Obama demands.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's just about rolling over and surrendering, then I would take gridlock to just rolling over and surrendering every day, which is what people are doing. But the other part of it is, until people feel it, like the people in Wisconsin felt it, until the people who have exhausted their unemployment benefits, until the people who are struggling to pay rent at a place they can't afford because they lost their homes, which they couldn't afford, until folks start to figure out that they've got to come together and figure out a different direction that they got to go in and developing new organizations to get them there, then this is what we got.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. Wall Street, hedge funds, and rich people of all kinds have taken a huge interest in charter schools. Charter schools are paid for with public money, but run by outside organizations. We asked Doug Henwood of Left Business Observer why the wealthy have invested their political clout and their capital in charter schools.
I think several things are going on. First of all, people who make a lot of money often want to be seen as important people beyond the world of money. So they turn to philanthropy as their way of establishing themselves as just more than money men. You know, we saw that 19th century with Andrew Carnegie, more recently with Bill Gates and George Soros. But those guys, I wouldn't call them liberal in a sense, but you know, they had a kind of public-spirited notion and the institution-building idea of how to go about philanthropy. Hedge fund guys tend to be more like lone wolves, revere the lone entrepreneur. I think they think that this is a form of philanthropy. They're doing good by promoting charter schools. They tend to be very libertarian in their political philosophies. They think that the public sector is evil, you know, somewhere between inefficient and evil or some combination of the two, and that the way to get some kind of educational progress is to break free of the public sector monopoly and create these entrepreneurial, creative, loosely regulated private schools, or charter schools, rather, which are non-union. These guys hate unions. They work the teaching staff very, very hard, 60 hours a week, you know, 5.5 days a week. They think that they're doing something socially good by promoting a free market approach to education. I think they also see this as a way for to turn schools into money-making opportunities. Many of the charter schools contract out for a lot of services. There's a move by a lot of these kinds of education reformers. I just myself interviewed Terry Moe at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, who's a big supporter of replacing teachers with computers. He thinks that teachers' unions are evil, and what we need to do is replace teachers with computer-based instruction. And I think a lot of these hedge fund guys look to this with excitement, too. Not only can they do good by their own view of things by breaking up the public sector monopoly, they and their friends can make some money in the process. You know, we saw Joel Klein, who had been the head of New York City school systems, went off to work for Rupert Murdoch's education division. We see that Pearson, the conglomerate that publishes the Financial Times, among other things, is also very big in testing, creating the standardized tests that charter schools and other public schools now are being forced to administer. So I think it's a combination of things. It's a way to ensure some kind of philanthropic legacy at the same time as an opportunity to promote the free market as they see it, to break the public sector, to break unions, and also for private companies to make money in what are now mostly public sector activities where it's very hard to make money.
We can understand the ideological motivation, but there is a huge money stream in public funds that go to charter schools for services, and in fact there is even a real estate market in private schooling that is investable by people like hedge funds folks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of opportunities for them here. A lot of private charter schools contract out for management, so they have education management organizations that gives opportunity for public sector making money off of public funds. There's all the testing that goes on. That's another opportunity for money making. Yeah, as you say, real estate as well. In New York, money the charter schools are just squeezing aside existing public schools using the same buildings. But, you know, around the country, they can also raise funds and build and have some real estate opportunities as well. I think to a lot of these folks, making money and doing good are pretty much the same thing. They really think that the market is good for everyone. And if they're making money, making lots of money, well, they must be making a social contribution. The ideology fits their material interest just perfectly.
Charter schools seem in some ways like a speculator's dream. The public takes most of the risk. It's mostly public funds, and the investor stands to profit.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the record of some of these for-profit school chains, like the Edison schools, they're not so good. I mean, they've never been able to turn a profit on these things. They've not made money on it. But if you get a guaranteed stream of public money coming into your charter schools, you can just skim off the fees. If the system works or not, doesn't matter to you because you just made the money, you pocketed the money and ran. These guys are not terribly interested in the long term. They want to pocket what they can as quickly as possible and move on to something else. The record on charter schools is spotty at best, but that doesn't seem to be stopping anybody. It's funny, all these business guys who are promoting charter schools, all these, you know, Wall Street people like Paul Tudor Jones or, you know, the mayor of New York, also a Wall Street person, Michael Bloomberg. Now, these guys profess to be really into what they call metrics. You know, you're supposed to have objective measures of success or failure. They're always promoting all these objective tests. They're supposed to judge teachers and judge student progress. Well, the actual results of these things are not so good. But that doesn't stop them. I mean, it's remarkable that they profess to be talking about results and accountability, but the results are not really coming out in their direction. They press on anyway, which makes you think that that combination of ideology and money-making is really what's driving it. And a very sincere, very passionate desire to cut public spending. And that's another angle here as well. Charter school teachers tend to be non-union, tend to work very long weeks. They're young. They burn out very quickly. So you can pay them a lot less and ultimately deeply cut public spending. They may talk about trying to improve educational outcomes, but I think that's what they're really trying to do. What they're looking for, I think, are very cheap holding pens until the students graduate into McDonald's or jail. I think that's really what they're looking to do, and they're not really looking to improve educational outcomes. So if you have the possibility of making money on something, breaking unions, making an ideological point, and also reducing public spending and cutting taxes, which means mainly cutting taxes for rich folks, from their point of view, it's, as they like to say, a win-win-win.
And from an ideological standpoint, they would abhor the professionalization of teachers and favor a kind of system that has young people coming in, kind of slumming it for a couple of years and then moving on to more lucrative professions.
Yeah, I mean, the advocates of this position claim that there is just absolutely no benefit for experience beyond a few years, so that after 3 or 5 years, teachers don't get any better, but they expect higher salaries and less onerous working conditions. So why not just get rid of them? So you just get a fresh crop of kids straight out of school. You know, their ideal is this thing like the Teach for America program, where you get kids maybe out of elite schools who will teach for a couple of years and then decide that's not for them and move on to a law school or business school, but they don't hold teachers in very high regard. They don't think it's an important, complicated profession that takes time to learn. They think they're just people who stand up in front of a class and mouth off expensively and don't work long enough day or week or year. So if you can replace them by computers, and if you can't, replace them by young people who could be paid very poorly, and that will eventually save money that means the government can spend less money, and it means that you can reduce taxes for rich folks.
Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer in New York. This summer we'll see a series of actions to protest U.S. military aggression in Africa. On August 20th, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is launching actions in cities across the United States, including Washington, D.C., New York, Philadelphia, Houston, Milwaukee, St. Petersburg, Florida, Oakland, and San Diego, California, and in London, Toronto, and the Bahamas. It's called a day of action on the other wars being those that are ignored by many in the anti-war movement. President Obama takes that logic even further, making war on Libya, but denying he's engaged in any hostilities with that country. We spoke with Ifeia Wangaza of the Black Is Back Coalition.
It's an insult to common decency and intelligence to say that dropping bombs on residential communities and declaring that clear efforts to assassinate the leader of a sovereign state that doesn't constitute war is just on its face a lie.
Well, President Obama, he says if U.S. personnel are not in danger, then it's not really a hostility.
That's very interesting. In fact, I listened to the whole debate about keeping our troops safe when they've been parachuted into somebody else's country for the purposes of stealing their land, exploiting their people, and murdering those who doesn't cooperate. And a primary concern should be one of safety. But I think that's all consistent with the notion of who or what constitutes humanity, or certainly human beings of worth. And in this instance, we see the perpetuation of the notion of white male supremacy at its grossest. And the idea is that if the person is not in fact or a representative or agent of white supremacy, white, preferably male, then he or she is not worth counting, not worth considering, and certainly not worth saving.
The United States either has achieved or is trying to achieve something that it calls full spectrum supremacy, which would allow it to attack countries without great danger to its own armed forces, especially in what we used to call the Third World.
Absolutely. And that is precisely what they've come to. And it's, I think, an indication of the level of planning that's gone on in recognition of the fact that whites as a class of people on the planet, or those human beings who classify themselves as white, are reaching such minority proportions that the definitions of everything has to be changed, and the greater use of technology in warfare has to be engaged. So we're going now purely through an experimental process for the purposes of their shoring up that long-planned strategy for maintaining military supremacy on the planet.
Historically, Europeans and later Americans have refused to classify their colonial exploits, their subjugation of other peoples, as wars.
One of the things that's been very interesting and instructive and maddening for me over the past 12 months in dealing with the United States on the international stage in the United Nations around the question of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles specifically, are the games that are played with images. And to the extent that the United States is the home of Hollywood and the master of images, second only to Goebbels and company in the Third Reich, the United States has managed to sell the rest of the world, as well as its own citizenry, a bill of goods that is at its core pathological and dangerous. It threatens the survival of the planet and all of humanity and everything else on it.
Right now, the United States is engaged in at least 6 shooting wars. That's an increase from George Bush's record.
Barack Obama, before he was elected, I was interviewed by a reporter from The Nation magazine, and I referred to him at that time as a Trojan horse, a chameleon Trojan horse that would bring in to being any and everything that corporations and imperialism sought, but that George Bush would never even dream of mentioning. And he has not only been the disappointment that I and some small number of us thought he would be, but he has become a disgrace. In fact, I can barely wait until he comes to Greenville, South Carolina to campaign before I will again disrupt his rally to call him to account for his abuse of the love, admiration, and longing of people, African people particularly, but people generally who want a different world, who wanted a different government, and placed that trust misguidedly in his hands. He has been able to lay the platform for war and destruction of humanity for the next 100 years. And unless we are able to pull ourselves, meaning African people, pull ourselves back from the brink, we will continue to be fodder for the global system of white supremacy and its agents, which is all Barack Obama actually is.
And how does U.S. foreign policy, how is it reflected domestically?
The United States is a military base built with stolen labor on stolen land and continuing to engage in a criminal enterprise of pillaging and plunder and rape across the planet. And that those who at any time, whether it was African who were liberating themselves and becoming Maroons or rising up in rebellion in the cases of Denmark Vesey or Harriet Tubman or even Sojourner Truth as a woman on one hand, or Geronimo and others, indigenous peoples on the others, to reclaim their land. This country has always been engaged internally at war. And that it has always held political prisoners, and that the only difference has been the manifestation as reflected in the times. We must no longer allow them to present their so-called aspirational history as fact. We must challenge them at every point, because words and ideas, as we know, have meaning. And unless the words and the ideas are accurate, then the behavior never will be.
That was Afia Wangaza. In addition to the Black is Back Coalition's August 20th Day of Action, demonstrators will take to the streets in Harlem on August 13th to protest the war against Libya and U.S. sanctions against Zimbabwe. Cynthia McKinney's Eyewitness Libya tour is crisscrossing the country and will arrive at New York's historic Riverside Church on July 30th.
Madison, Wisconsin is the site of a convention on democracy to convene August 24th through 28th. Ben Mansky of the Liberty Tree Foundation is one of the organizers. We asked Mansky, what's different about this democracy convention?
Well, first, there's the timing. We're at one of those moments in American history when there really is this widespread crisis of confidence in capitalism, in our system of government in the United States. And so people are looking for something much deeper, something much more radical to address what all of us are facing in this country. Something else that sets it apart is the location. We're hosting the Democracy Convention in Madison, Wisconsin. The Capitol Square in Madison, where we'll actually be meeting, is now as famous in many parts of the world as Tahrir Square in Cairo. And so many people who are coming from around the country are very excited to be coming to Madison. But I think beyond the time and place of the convention, there's a reality that this is a gathering that prioritizes building a movement for democracy in the United States, a genuine, broad-based, deeply rooted movement to democratize all the institutions of this country. So this is not just about resistance. This is not about piecemeal reforms. This is about a thorough revolution, not only of values, but also of structure, our political system, and our economic system. And that's what I think is really drawing people, because they're looking for a long-term solution to these systemic problems.
We see you have no less than 9 separate little mini conventions. Why was that done?
You can't call a democracy movement into life by simply working on voting rights and election reform, or by simply having a meeting in Washington, D.C. and pressuring members of Congress. If you want to build a democracy movement, you have to build it on the ground where people eat, live, pray, work, you name it. And so what people have been doing around the country for many years now is working to build pro-democracy campaigns in different areas of life. There's been work to democratize our schools and colleges. There's been work to build local democracy and community power. There's been work to democratize defense. And so what the Democracy Convention is doing with these 9 separate democracy conferences is that we're having the ability for people to continue the real work that's on the ground that they're doing to strengthen it. And we're bringing together all these conferences under one roof in one convention so that we can find the solidarities that exist between the different types of work and show that there's a there. I mean, in many ways, this convention is about having a coming of age, a coming out party, so to speak, for the democracy movement in the United States. So when you can see that there's work going on to introduce participatory budgeting to local government, that there's work going on to democratize the governance of our schools and colleges and to get full funding to higher education and to K-12, when you see the work that's going on to democratize defense, to protect the rights of GIs, to bring home the National Guard, when you see the work of Move to amend the Constitution, when you see all these different areas of work in one place, where all these folks are really centralizing democratic reforms that lead to altogether a democratic revolution in this country, then you think, wow, this is actually possible.
And at the end of this process, would we see 9 manifestos or plans to move forward, or 1 broad manifesto and plan to move forward?
Well, I think in some ways we're pushing the envelope with this convention, but in others we're trying not to push it too far. So there are not plans at the convention to come up with statements or sort of lists of proposals and so on. But we expect that there will be another democracy convention in 2 years. We also have a lot of exchange and overlap with other processes that are going on in the United States right now. First and foremost, the U.S. Social Forum, but also the mobilization for October in Washington, D.C. So we're not trying to force a series of bullet points proposals right now, because the reality is that there are real campaigns that are afoot in the United States that altogether do look like a broader movement for democracy. So you have the movements for constitutional reform. You have all the movements that I was naming earlier. Many of the people who are coming together in Madison have worked together for many years, but there are also many people coming together who've worked together in different areas of life and maybe haven't been in the same room together. So, you know, I think it's going to be a huge victory to have people come together to see each other and to recognize that we do, in fact, have this movement in the United States that you can call a capital D, capital M, democracy movement, just as for many years we've had a labor movement, women's movement, student movement, so many movements in this country. We now finally have a democracy movement in the United States. And to simply come out of the convention with that realization and also with the ability to move forward in the coming months and years, I think will be a very important step.
So this is a novel format and forum for assessing what the state of the movement is and for people to get their bearings.
Yeah, in many respects. I mean, you know, people, there have been a number of people who have been saying, oh, I'm very excited to be coming to this democracy convention. I'm sorry I wasn't able to make the last one. But the reality is that there wasn't the last one. There's been other work that has led to this point, certainly. But it is a new moment, I think, in our current work. And I think after this convention, I think that the level of activity will increase to another level entirely.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Nellie Bailey will be back next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Barry Dwyer.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.